You're listening to Section D, first broadcast on the 15th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. This December, the Monocle team decamped to Florida for the Design Miami exhibition. In last week's Section D, we covered the best of the show itself. But there were plenty of other design-minded delights to be enjoyed in sunny South Beach beyond the main venue, and that's where we're shining the spotlight today. To begin with, we check in with renowned urbanist Richard Florida to talk about his vision for how Miami should develop in the near future and beyond.
Miami is changing quite rapidly, and it's kind of growing up. You know, it's moving from a tourist place and a fun in the sun and party all the time, go to clubs. It's trying to mature.
Then, Elle Decor's editor-in-chief Michael Boudreau and Miami-based designer Sam Robin tell us about the newly opened Modern Life concept house in Wynwood, Miami.
The neighborhood itself is a canvas for creativity of all kinds, everything from tag-based graffiti art to really refined works.
We also have Monocle's Josh Fennett and Megan Billings discussing the Miami design scene, and finish up with a special package from Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about the intersection between architecture and disco in Italy. All that to look forward to in the next half hour, right here on Section D. Miami is at a crossroads of becoming more than just fun in the sun. Through public art, great architecture, and neighborhood development, the city is developing a vibrant urban environment. With the Creative City Initiative, urbanist Richard Florida and Florida International University are working to propel the creativity of the changing city forward. Megan Billings caught up with Richard recently to talk about how the city is using design and development to build a more lovable and livable place for its residents.
You know, I think Miami is really at a kind of big inflection point. You know, obviously, after the crash, people thought Miami was in deep straits. The real estate economy completely tanked. You know, buildings were literally empty. But what happened is, I think, because there's a great airport, because Miami is connected not only to Latin America, but is a gateway to Europe and all over the world, I think it's become kind of a destination, not just for the creative types, obviously for creative types, artists, designers, interior designers, all of this, but as a winter destination. You know, I think part of what's happening is the world's destinations are in a way shrinking, becoming, I like the word, spikier. So this kind of global creative class, if you want to call it that, gathers in Miami for part of the winter. And of course, Art Basel's the kind of apex of that. The issue is that Miami's creative economy is thin. Now, there are beautiful architects working all over, and great designers, and fantastic hotels, and fantastic condominiums, and fantastic homes for the global super rich, you know. But in contrast to perhaps London or New York, other superstar cities, or even San Francisco with tech, or Los Angeles with media and entertainment, Miami doesn't really have a robust local creative economy. It lives on this input of people. And, you know, if London is divided, if New York is unequal and led to the rise of Bill de Blasio, if San Francisco people are protesting the techies, Miami is even much more unequal and divided. And, you know, if you go a block or two blocks off the waterfronts, whether that's the bay or the oceanfront, you know, you come face to face with, you know, some of the richest people in the world on one side, the global super rich on one side, and then sort of endemic poverty on the other. So I think those are the issues that Miami has to confront in its next wave of development.
So thinking about that development that's happening, there's construction everywhere in Miami, and it is these kind of big architect buildings. But on the other end, I do think that there's a desire here from the population to have a city center again, to have neighborhoods, and that is happening. But can you just tell me about that?
Well, you know, I've been coming here ever since we moved to Toronto, where winters are really cold. We've been coming here. So that's 8 or 10 years. In that period, the redevelopment of the urban fabric of Greater Miami has been nothing short of remarkable. We talked about cranes. I mean, you think about what's happened in say, South Beach, and South Beach in neighborhoods that were really quite devastated. That has been nearly completely rebuilt into a wonderfully functional residential, live-work, mixed use. And what's interesting about South Beach is yes, there are parts of it on the waterfront that are expensive, but in the interior, you know, around Flamingo Park and in the interior in these walkable mid-rise multifamily units, service workers, people who work in the restaurants, people who drive Ubers, people who work in the cruise lines can afford to live. What's even more remarkable, of course, is the renovation and refurbishing and the reurbanization of Miami. You know, Miami, the city, was maybe not quite in the category of Detroit or Cleveland or Newark, where I was born, Newark, but very distressed. The high rates of poverty, high rates of abandonment, high rates of homelessness. And, you know, what we've seen is really the reconstruction of a new downtown. Now, that downtown is different than some other downtowns. It's more stretched out and elongated. But right now, it's what we're in the middle of is this process of rebuilding. Very quick, though, you know, how many other cities, metropolitan areas, have been rebuilt in under 10 years? That's really the time frame that's happened in Miami. And so we're really in this process of kind of on-site, real-time city building. And now, as the towers go up, as the condominiums go up, as the hotels go up, as the architecture goes up, you're going to have to do the real task of city building, which is making sure neighborhoods are functional and making sure people are connected, not just by cars. This is a way too car-dependent place, connected by transit and biking and walking.
I guess I'm also just curious if this is a situation. So Brickell, you mentioned, is really under construction, and there's a big push for that to become a kind of downtown central place again. Is this a situation of if you build it, they will come?
I think Brickell is a good example of if you build it and the economy crashes, they do come. That said, I think there's another current that's happening in Miami, and that is not just old farts. You know, not just people 65 and older. This is no longer God's waiting room. What I've seen in the past 5 years is much younger people migrating to Miami across a wide barometer of types. I've seen financial types who are just tired of living the hard life in New York, and quite frankly, because they're money conscious, tired of paying the taxes of New York, so they move here and they get a lovely home and commute. We're seeing business CEOs move their families here and set up a family situation and commute to New York or wherever. We're seeing people from London and Paris and Stockholm move their families here because they're tired of bad weather. We're seeing, of course, this massive migration of people from Latin America. But the other thing is we're seeing young families. I mean, it's fascinating to me that a place that was in a way built for single life and swinging life, it's becoming much more family friendly. And I think people are moving here, especially as housing prices and housing becomes so unaffordable in cities like New York. And they're saying, you know, well, where could I go? I could go to LA. Well, San Francisco is just as expensive. The Bay Area is just as expensive. I could go to Detroit. That has a great vibe. But Miami, there's a lot of value for your dollar. And you get nice weather. And especially if you have kids, you know, you get the 9 months that are nice and you can get away during hurricane season. So I think it's really in this game-changing perspective, and it's really just happening as we talk. This is, even 5-6 years ago, you wouldn't have seen this. It's really happening. So I really think Miami is changing quite rapidly beyond the buildings. The buildings are a signal and a symbol beyond the buildings, and it's kind of growing up. You know, it's moving from a tourist place and a fun in the sun and party all the time, go to clubs. That's trying to mature into a modern kind of business-oriented creative economy. And that's interesting to watch it happen.
That was Monocle's Megan Billings talking to urbanist Richard Florida. For the past few years, US magazine Elle Decor has hosted displays of artfully decorated concept houses in new developments around Miami. These annual exhibitions give local designers a platform to show off their work, as well as raising money and awareness for a good cause. Monocle's Josh Fennett spoke to Elle Decor's editor-in-chief Michael Boudreau to find out more about the Elle Decor's current concept house in Wynwood. He also caught up with contributing designer Sam Robin to learn more about the Miami scene.
Wynwood was really an industrial area, mostly warehouses, mostly one- and two-story buildings, and it started to become taken over by street artists about 6 or 7 years ago. It was kind of a forgotten neighborhood in the city, and because of the structure of the buildings, there were huge expanses of walls. And a couple of developers began buying up the buildings, and actually, instead of discouraging graffiti or street art, they began encouraging it. And the neighborhood has really thrived as a result. It became known for its street art and the walls, which they hired different artists to come in and keep them up for 6 months a year. It's really a canvas. The neighborhood itself is a canvas for creativity of all kinds, everything from tag-based graffiti art to really refined works. And people come here to see the works, to see how they've changed. And as a result, cafes started coming, restaurants, and it's really become I would say probably, aside from South Beach, the most active area for pedestrians, for people walking out at night. It's really, like 11 o'clock at night, this neighborhood will be incredibly busy, and that's rare in most cities.
And this building's a new jewel in its crown. It's a beautiful space, if you don't mind me saying. There's also a philanthropic mission behind what you're doing.
Yes.
But maybe I can ask you about the importance of, as a magazine in these, you know, sometimes torrid times for print, the importance of being involved in things that are bigger than the printed product. Putting your name to selecting people for and putting your judgment out there into the kind of design world. Can you tell me a little bit about the importance of that for El Deco?
Of course. Show houses have proliferated in the last 10 years or so, and they're a wonderful way for designers to show off their creativity, but they can also be a burden on designers, especially young designers, because it's very time-consuming, takes time from their other projects. It can be very expensive for them. So one of the things that we developed over the years was the idea of the concept house. So it's a show house, but we also pair designers with advertisers who will supply a majority of product. So we want to allow the designers their own creativity, but also to give them something to work with so it's not such a burden on them and on their bottom line. So we go after 6 or 7 major advertisers, and they will help create the kitchens, the bathrooms, supply furnishings. Of course, the designers are not only allowed but encouraged to have their own creativity and to bring in items that express their personal take. But it just gives them sort of a cushion, a mattress, to know that 80% of the furnishings or 60% of the furnishings or the closet details, they don't have to worry about. So it gives our advertisers a chance to show their creativity as used by a very talented designer. But it also gives the designer an easier way to do these kind of things. And then the proceeds that we raise funds from the sponsoring advertisers and from the sale of the tickets, and those go to our favorite charity in Miami, which is the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Care Center in Miami, which does amazing work in terms of bringing in the community and really reducing the rate of cancer. It's a wonderful, wonderful organization, and we're thrilled to be partnering with them.
And I know you're busy and I've already taken a lot of your time, but I'll ask you one final question. I mean, there's a huge confluence of incredibly talented designers. The world's press is here. But I wonder how you feel about Floridian design and about Miami's design scene and the kind of natives here as well. Are they getting I know you're doing your bit by nominating them to do the rooms, but are they getting a good deal out of all the attention that Miami gets? And how do you see that scene at the minute?
Well, I could see if I lived in Miami, I might feel that, you know, Design Miami, Art Basel is bringing a lot of strangers in, invading my city. And I'm sure there's a little bit of resentment about that. But I also think that designers here are incredibly responsive to the world. What's great about Miami is such an international city, especially from Latin America. Europeans are coming increasing numbers. So it's an international city, a global city. And I think that the designers here respond to that and sort of understand that. I'm sure when they're sitting in traffic, they are cursing what's going on. But I think when they see something like at the Concept House or go to Design Miami and see the incredible range of design and high-end products and things that are brought to the city, you know, incredible antiques, beautiful new designs, special commissions, it generates a lot of excitement. And I think it's inspiring for the designers. So on a day-to-day basis for a week, maybe they're cursing a little bit, but I think they're also inspired for the year to come. And I think it's a great thing for the city, and it's really helped bring together so many different communities, the art community, the design community, cultural institutions. It's really been fantastic about having the city coalesce and realizing Miami is a creative center and really is on the cusp of what's new and what's next.
I'm Sam Robin. I'm an interior designer in Miami, Florida. And we did the master suite hangout room in the El Decor Modern Showcase House.
And you're one of a number of designers who's been approached to design different spaces. Can you tell me a little bit about the concept and how it came about?
Well, first of all, you know, every year they do a project for a charity, and we raise money for the comprehensive cancer care at Silvestri, which Dr. Niemer is like the star researcher, and we're really grateful for all the work they do there. We're in Wynwood, and for those who don't know Wynwood, it's an artist retreat. It's a haven here of graffiti and incredible art everywhere you go, and it's an expression part of our city. So in this master suite, even though it's an upscale building, you know, for this area, new and coming, we wanted it to have a funky chic. We didn't want it to be so serious. We wanted it to be like a retreat. We made it a little bit darker because Miami is bright sun, which you can see from this suite, you know, but you have that calming effect to really retreat to and just chill out.
So tell me a little bit about the effect of a design week and Art Basel Miami on the city. And you said that this is an up-and-coming area. How much is the Miami design scene kind of changing?
Last night I had dinner with Sam Keller, who brought this whole concept from Basel, Switzerland, and really put Miami on the map. I mean, before this happened, there was no place in the United States that had an art scene that brought the best contemporary galleries from all over the world. And that's how it began. And from that, it became a destination city. And the artists started to flock here. This area, like all areas that become an artist haven, was run down, poor, deserted. The artists come in, and now it's too expensive probably for the artists to live here, which tends to happen in a changing city, an emerging city, which Miami definitely is. You've got the hit of the multicultures. You've got, like, that passion to South America. You've got millions of Italians and French coming in, too. It's becoming a global destination because of our weather and because of scenes like Art Basel, which has really revolutionized the way the world looked at Miami.
That was Miami-based designer Sam Robin. And before that, Elle Decor's editor-in-chief Michael Boudreau talking to Josh Fennett about the newly opened Modern Life concept house in Wynwood, Miami. Still to come on Section D, Josh is joined by Monocle's Megan Billings to chat about their experience of Miami's design scene. Plus, we bring you a report from an exhibition at London's Institute of Contemporary Arts, all about the intersection of visionary architecture and disco in Italy. Do keep listening.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
Next up on our wider lens look at Miami, we take the temperature of the city's fast-changing design scene. Monocle has been out in force reporting for our new travel guide to the city, our 8th city guide so far. It's printed in collaboration with German publisher Gestalten and can be relied upon to point visitors to the city's hotspots in everything from art and design to food and drink. Earlier, Monocle's Josh Fennett sat down with Megan Billings, a New York-based researcher and writer who reported the guide, to find out more about the fast-changing city.
So perhaps, Megan Billings, we could start off by talking about your impressions of Miami, and they'll be slightly more focused than mine, because you've obviously completed the Miami Travel Guide, which comes out for Monocle in November. We were both there last week, covering Design Miami. Can you tell me some of your impressions about the Miami design scene, and perhaps how, when reporting the guide, these sort of changed over time?
So I think that, firstly, Miami is a city that no one's surprised that there's a lot of art there. But in terms of design, that exists as well. I think it still has some time to get to the same place that the art scene really is. Reporting the guide was really interesting because the city, everyone knows South Beach. But what we really did was focus on the city of Miami itself, which is seeing a lot of revitalization. And I think there's a sense from people that they really want a city center again. And so they're kind of really building that.
And we heard earlier in the show your interview with Richard Florida, but I gather that he's not the only person that you've met who is trying to change the way that the city kind of runs and change the sort of the architecture and development of the city for the better. You and I visited the Vagabond Motel, which is run by an interesting property developer. Can you tell me about some of these interesting voices who are sort of changing the city for the better?
I think, you know, the first and most recognizable person is Craig Robbins. And he started a development company in 1987 and really started revitalizing South Beach by buying up buildings and kind of making those Art Deco beauties part of the city again. And I spoke with him about a year ago, and he was talking about it and just saying that he didn't see art or architecture or design as something that one person has. He's a collector of art and design objects as well. And these buildings he really sees as design objects, and he wants to kind of give those back to the city. I mean, what he's done there on South Beach, he's now trying to do in the design district as well, which is was kind of desolate at a time, and now has all of this like luxury that's there. And then Average Jane, who you mentioned, runs the Vagabond Motel, which was completely run down. She bought it for $2 million and has made an absolute kind of mid-century beauty out of that. And she's doing that in Little River, which is another neighborhood that needs revitalization as well. And she bought something called the Miami River Inn, which will be opening in the new year.
And so you've mentioned a couple of different areas and that it was important when you were putting the guide together, not solely to focus on the Art Deco district and the beautiful kind of pristine beaches. But I wonder if Miami as a whole does well by the fact that it hosts an increasing number of design fairs. Do you think that maybe too much attention might be being given to, say, promoting international galleries, or, you know, there's a gallery that visits from Paris or from New York or from elsewhere? Do you think enough is being done to foster local talent, or do you think that comes over time and having the world's gaze, all of the critics, curators and gallerists there is a good thing while it develops, or, you know, is there a balance to be struck?
I think it is a great thing in the sense that what Design Miami and Art Basel does for the city is put this spotlight on the city for a time every year. And so that sense of being watched by the international community and having those people come in, I think, makes people who live there hold themselves to a higher degree or so. You know, I think, as I said, the art scene is doing really well, but the design scene, there was really only one thing at Design Miami that really struck me as incredible, that could stand on the international stage and was a local designer. And that was at Giovanni Beltran, Jonathan Gonzalez, who is an architect in Miami and now doing furniture, and that was outstanding.
And that was Monocle's Megan Billings talking to Josh Fennett about last week's event in Design Miami and the future of the Miami design scene. Next up, a hint of what's to come in the year ahead, as Josh speaks to the newly appointed director of Maison et Objet Americas, Gaston Isoldi.
One of the reasons why we choose Miami is because, you know, this city, you can feel the vibe, you know, in this city. It is a conjunction between Europe, US, and Latin America. So it's the center of two continents. And that's why we choose Miami to set Maison Objet in this continent.
And for people familiar with the Parisian installment, it's an enormous trade fair. How much smaller is the Miami one? Roughly how many, how big is the space and how many people do you kind of get involved?
Well, in this particular case, we just launched the first edition in last May. So we took out of the entire convention center, we took one hall out of the four halls, and we finished with a waiting list. We gathered 300 brands exhibiting, and we receive a total of 8,600 unique visitors from 82 countries. So we are overwhelmed. No, we're very, very excited about this first edition. For next year, which will take place in May from the 10th through the 13th, we expanded the show to two halls. So we are very, very excited.
So amazing progress already just after a single installment. Can you tell us what we can expect? I know it's too early for the announcements, but a little hint about what we can expect or what we can start getting excited about if there's a theme or...
Well, basically, what we're trying to do is to get more representation from the Americas. Part of my responsibilities is with the team in Paris and the people that we have in Brazil, in Mexico, in the U.S., is going deep in the market and discover the hidden gems we have here. So we travel a lot because Maison Objet is a creative fair. We want to go there and see from firsthand the manufacturers, speak with the designers and see how they finish the products, which materials are using. So that's the thing that we are looking for next year, is to get more representation of this continent as well.
That was Gaston Isoldi, the newly announced director of Maison et Objet Americas. And before that, Monocle's own Megan Billings. Both of them were speaking to Monocle's Josh Fennett about Miami's budding design credentials. And to end the show, something completely different. During the 60s and 70s, Italian discotheques were taken by storm by a group of architects belonging to the radical design movement. They were a socially progressive group that saw discos as a new type of space for creative liberation. The ICA in London is presently holding an exhibition about the movement and their influence on Italian nightlife. To learn more, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Catherine Rossi, co-curator of Radical Disco, Architecture and Nightlife in Italy, 1965 to 1975.
I've actually co-curated the show with an ICA curator called Sumitra Upham, who invited me to curate this exhibition with her. And it's based on my research on Italian design, which I've been doing for a few years now. And in particular, last year, I curated an installation at the 2014 Venice Architecture Biennale on Space Electronic, which is one of the discos that we feature in the exhibition. And it seems to have exploded from there into this bigger show.
And can you tell us more about the style of those discos? I mean, were they quite similar in a way? Was it like a movement, or they were quite different from each other?
They were similar in terms of their ideas. Many of the discos that we feature were designed by architects associated with radical design, which was this movement of architects and designers in the mid-1960s and 70s in Italy, which sought to overturn all the conventions of their professions. And they were quite fed up with architecture and design, fed up with its modernist market orientation. And so they wanted to use the tools of what they did for societal change, for innovation, for creating an architecture that was closer with how we actually lived. So the discos themselves were seen as these new kind of architectural spaces where they could experiment with new materials, so lots of plastics, for example, in one of the discos, with lots of new technologies. So in Space Electronic and also in the Piper, which was one of the discos in Turin, they had a lot of audiovisual projection, a lot of early light shows, for example. But they were really these kind of black box containers that were turned on each night for entertainment, for letting yourself loose.
Can you describe, I mean, I have a picture, I believe is the one that you just mentioned, Piper in Turin. And, you know, it looks fun, it looks colorful, and as you said, you know, it looks very modernist as well. There was quite a, I would say, a big change in Italy at the time as well.
Yeah, the image is that we're using for the publicity is of the Piper in Turin, which was one of the first radical discos, as we'd call it, from 1966, I think that's right. And one of the architects who designed it was Pietro De Rossi, who's coming to talk to us in London next week about the exhibition. And it's got this use of bright colours, of plastics, which have been used more generally in Italian design. But the key features of that particular disco is that all the furniture and all the components were movable. So you could change the space as and when and how you wanted it. So it was a lot freer in terms of this kind of engagement with the user.
Do you think they were, I mean, quite relevant? I mean, to be honest, just looking at this picture, I can imagine like a club today being a little bit like this in a way. Would you say that's true that they, you know, they were so influential that, you know, you can still see signs of that?
That's a really good question, because the story of these discotheques has really been lost in terms of they're not featured at all in architecture and design history. And I think that's part of a larger overlooking of these nocturnal spaces in these kind of histories, because maybe they're not seen as serious enough. And certainly in terms of the architects of these discos, who included the likes of Superstudio of Gruppo 999, who were part of the radical movement, there's a kind of idea that these architects didn't build anything. So actually, I think for me, there's a legacy in these spaces that we haven't yet traced. So this is very much an ongoing research project. Like, what was the influence of the kind of architecture of all the connections that were made in these spaces?
Catherine, just to end on a very good note, I would like you to choose a song, you know, that might relate to those discotheques.
Well, I think the obvious song that comes to mind is I Feel Love, with Donna Summer's voice and obviously Giorgio Moroder as producer. It was one of the songs that they played, early music videos also that were shown in Space Electronic, and it just really sums up the disco vibe.
What a wonderful choice. This is I Feel Love.
That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco talking to Catherine Rossi, co-curator of the exhibition Radical Disco, Architecture and Nightlife in Italy, 1965-75. You can catch the exhibition at London's Institute of Contemporary Arts until January the 10th. That's it for this week's show. A very big thanks to Alex Funnell, who was the editor. If you have any comments or queries, please feel free to drop me a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan, and until next time, it's goodbye from me.